Recorded live in downtown Newtown, this is Rancho Notorious, a podcast about movies and other cool stuff. You can find this and all of the other episodes of the show at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious. Welcome, everybody, to Season 1, Episode 4 of Rancho Notorious. And please excuse my slightly stuffed-up, mucus-infused tones. I'm feeling much better today, but I tell you what, if we had tried to record this show yesterday, it simply wouldn't have happened. I wouldn't have been able to get off my sick bed. So luckily we have two fantastic other people here in the studio who are going to take most of the burden from me. My name is Dan Slevin, and here with me tonight we have
Kaylee Carruthers
and Doug Dillerman.
Hey Doug.
Hey there.
Welcome to Rancho Notorious.
Thanks for having me.
It's a real pleasure to have you here with us, and I guess to widen the family just a little bit more. And you know, we had you on the previous show by the electric Skype machine.
Yeah.
But here we are in the room, and you know, it's fantastic.
I get to meet Kayla in person for the first
time. I
know,
this is so exciting. It's like you can't go back from meeting someone from Twitter in real life.
It's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, you didn't get a chance to be introduced by me in terms of your many wonderful facets, your many the many calibers that you bring to us. Independent filmmaker, budding author, Lumiere reader reviewer. What else are you? You're a professional video editor.
Student
former.
Who's writing a book. And
yeah, well, yeah. You're writing a book. He's writing a book.
Snappy yeah. Dresser.
Oh, I didn't even try tonight.
Well, in comparison, yes, in comparison with the other male in the room who...
Yes.
I'm not wearing track pants. So
yeah, talking about new experiences tonight.
I'm a drummer.
A drummer?
Yeah, musician. Although I'm not really playing right now because I've got a few other things on which we'll be talking about.
Am I a little low there? Should I...
No, you're good.
Okay,
you're
cool.
Good. You're good. And we shall just fade out the theme music and... We're going to say, just look, Doug is here to do three things for us tonight. He's going to tell us about his feature film, Jake, which is screening in Auckland at the moment and arrives in Wellington next week.
Yeah.
He's going to help us review the new Transformers movie, which may or may not have actually made it to $100 million in the US box office on opening weekend. Some dispute about those figures. Who would have thought that a studio would fudge the figures in order to get a headline? And finally, we're also going to be chatting about the delightful animated French film Ernest and Celestine, which finally opens around the country today. And that's a film that I run the film page on Fishhead magazine, and once a month I get to say, and also opening in May, and also opening, and I think I've run Ernest and Celestine three times.
I've been waiting since January to get a second look at it, because I saw it at the film fest last year, and I'm like, January, it's coming back. March, it's coming back.
Oh, yeah, they just kept on bumping it, but we have it under good authority that it is actually opening today and playing in cinemas as we speak. So we'll be talking about that one. On top of all of that, we'll have the usual glut of news, stats, and opinion. Doug, we mentioned a little bit earlier on that you're writing for the Lumiere Reader.
Correct.
And so perhaps this will be a good opportunity for you to let listeners know, particularly those listeners who aren't in New Zealand, what the Lumiere Reader is and where it's come from and where they can find it.
Sure. Well, the Lumiere Reader was originally a print magazine founded by Tim Wong in 2003, who's a Wellington-based cineast, and went on to the web actually at the film festival in 2004 here. So this is going to be its 10th year anniversary. And you can find it on the web at lumiere.net.nz. And in addition to the two main editors besides Tim are Alexander Bisley and Brenda Van Nanolingam, but there's a whole passel of contributors, and originally I discovered it as a fan just from being online and They are one of the leading, they describe themselves as the leading film and arts culture site for New Zealand, and they're fantastic, lengthy, chunky pieces that really get under the skin of films and other things. For instance, the Eleanor Catton interview that Joan Fleming did about the luminaries has been one of the go-to pieces on that book. And so I just have got to know people involved over the years. I've been doing a podcast with one of the other contributors, Jacob Powell, called Best Worst Podcast, that turns up every couple months on your iTunes feeds when you least expect it. And we just drink scotch and we talk about either really good movies or really bad movies, depending on what we feel like. And yeah, and then I met Tim last year, and this year I've moved down to Wellington to do the Bill Manhire course at Vic, and Alexander and Tim have lured me into contributing for the site. So I've been writing about the Writers Festival and music and film for them for the last couple months.
It really is one of those rare sites on the web that revels in depth, doesn't it? It actually, you know, it takes advantage of the fact that there is no word limit on the internet, and you can really go into some depth, and you know, and not just length, but yeah, breadth and as well. It's the kind of thing that you just don't read in New Zealand culture anymore.
Yeah, or even often international film culture. I mean, so many people who are writing about film, for instance, are having to meet brief word counts and trying to go for sort of a page hit sort of culture, whereas Lumiere is entirely a passion project. And then the results just often show. The Steve James interview that went up recently that Alexander Bisley did, their production company said this is one of the best interviews with Steve we've ever seen, because he just went deep on the research and brought a lot of things that weren't just the talking points about, so Ebert this, Ebert that, you know, for the, this was around the Life Itself documentary, of course, and the piece that he did, that Tim did with Alex Duncan last year around the Red House, was one that really, you know, just dug deep into the film in a lot of different ways and shows a really concerted interest in things that you never get to talk about in other interviews.
Exactly.
The one that I did with him, I found that as well.
Yeah, Alexander Bisley, I think, is one of New Zealand's great interviewers, and and I appreciate that occasionally his stuff is making its way into print in the Sunday Star Times and the Listener and what have you. But most of his best work you'll find on Lumiere Reader, and you know, again, a real sort of unsung hero. So what are you going to be doing for them during the film festival? Have you been given an assignment, as it were?
The way it works is a bit that everybody puts their hands up for what they want to review and talk about. So I'll be reviewing a half dozen films. I think I've got Housebound, Borgman, Enemy, Maidan, Why Don't You, what's the Sion Sono film? Why Don't You Play in Hell? And a mysterious sixth one. The Salt of the Earth, the Wim Wenders film. And then I am also very excited because tomorrow morning, in advance of a piece I'll be doing on and with Jonathan King, I'll be seeing his new film, Reality, and the final tech check for that. And so I'll be doing a sit-down interview with him, talking about what it means to go and self-produce your own film on the back of two others. And so I'm really looking forward to that.
So are you going to actually be asking him questions about how to self-produce a film and self-release? Wouldn't it be the other way around?
Well, we've been through the same experience together. The only difference is he'd made two large features with Film Commission backing, and I never made a feature before. But in terms of having to going the whole DIY side of things, you know, we've had a similar path in that, discovering all the bumps and things along the way. And so hopefully I'll get to ask him the right questions that'll illuminate the experience for other readers.
It sounds fascinating. Maybe we should have a Rancho Notorious microphone sneaking in there to record it.
Maybe you and Lumiere can have a arm wrestling match for it.
That sounds good.
Yeah,
I'll take that.
If you can get Jonathan on the show, actually, he's a fantastic talker, and he's really knowledgeable about film history as well. Right. So I bet he'd have a lot to contribute.
Well, it's time to go to the mailbag, and I'm pretty sure that if you scroll back far enough, you'll see that that Jonathan King and Chad Taylor have been strong supporters of Rancho Notorious already, thanks to their to the fact that their film Reality was mentioned quite a lot last week.
Yes. So let's start out with some compliments to someone in the room. Jake, clever and creative, fun, hilarious take on a very scary premise. We'll keep an eye out for more of Dillerman's work. That's from Fred Thompson.
The legend, Fred Thompson.
The legend.
Wow. I hadn't seen that. Where did he say that?
To us.
Yeah, he talks.
Thanks, Fred. Wow.
Yeah, we're trying to track this, like, this lovely person down because they send so many reviews per week, and we're just so, like, I am so enamored by their just mad skill at the two-word review.
Yeah, I can't, and I, yeah, the two-word review thing is amazing, but just actually seeing as much as he does. I used to do it a lot, and now, you know, work and podcasting and, you know, family and all the rest of it, and I just can't see the films that I used to. And Fred is, he's living the dream.
Yeah, I know the feeling of having to cut down from the six a week to six a month.
Mm. Reese Pie says, Under the Skin is truly unique and a must-see. You won't look at people the same way again. Soundtrack is fab. Ooh, little Enzif preview for you.
Yeah, that's in my top five. I'm very excited for that film.
I'm saying nothing. Oh, what else? What else? So much.
Okay, so I don't know if you can hear this, catch this on the microphones, but we have a hysterical laughing 11-year-old in another room. We get this a lot in this house with his headphones on, watching Minecraft videos on YouTube.
Amazing.
Yeah, trying to turn him into
some reviews of those.
Of those, yeah. Well, it's it is a podcast about other cool stuff. Exactly. He did review Million Dollar Arm for us last week.
I did that.
So we're trying to turn him into a cinephile, but he just loves those Minecraft videos.
He's getting there. He's getting there. Mm. The Mirka tweeted, "Finally caught Ida before it left cinemas, and so glad I did. My two-word review is monochrome masterpiece."
It's fantastic. Have you got to see Ida yet, Dan?
I have, yes, and I really, really liked it. And I was just going to ask you guys a trivia question, and that is, do you know what the connection is between Ida, or Ida, perhaps?
Yeah, correct, actually,
Ida. Ida and Edge of Tomorrow.
Ooh, Emily Blunt, My Summer of Love.
Yes, indeed. Well spotted. Brow was furrowed ever so slightly there, and then he dredged it up. Yes, indeed. Emily Blunt was launched basically by My Summer of Love, directed by the same guy.
There you go. Yeah. Trivia.
We got it.
Speaking of trivial numbers and things, it's time for the top five, I think. International top five.
We should have a sting for the top five, shouldn't we? I've just decided we should have a little.
Pew, pew.
You should just do the Inception bomb five times.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the Inception bomb is like everywhere. Oh.
Yep. Good idea. Okay, we'll get on to that. Thank you.
Yeah. What is that noise anyway? Like, how does that noise even get created?
I think there's like a two-page long blog that the guy who did it used to describe all the filters and things. I think, yeah, I can't remember all the things that went into it, but it's...
Because when I go and watch a movie and I watch, you know, there's like three trailers in a row with that sound, I just cheer. I'm like, yes!
It was like when they were using the Requiem for a Dream score for everything forever. For 5 years. It's like Lord of the Rings, Requiem for a Dream.
And now it's, what's the guy's name? Arvo Pärt.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's who we're seeing all the time, hearing all the time. Okay, so, yes, what have Kiwis been watching this weekend?
Right, in at number five, still at five from last week, Blended, in at four, down from three, Fault in Our Stars, three down from one, 22 Jump Street, sitting at number two, What We Do in the Shadows, and number one, Transformers Age of Extinction.
And... you know, it's fantastic that What We Do in the Shadows had its week of
glory. Let's get it back in the number one, people.
Wow. I tell you what, because I would say that pretty much everybody who was going to go and see Transformers Age of Extinction has probably seen it by now, right? Like, they were going to go that opening weekend.
I went to see it at the Embassy last night, the Transformers movie, and they said that's the last showing in the big room at the Embassy because nobody's turning up, and What We Do in the Shadows will be there. Admittedly, the Embassy might not be the core audience for Transformers, but it is also the only Dolby Atmos house, so it was great to see great to see it as it was intended.
It's a lot of money in that in that opening 4 days. 1.8 million New Zealand dollars in that 4 days.
That's, was it 3D or 2D?
3D.
Yeah, well, it's mostly 3D. I think there're probably a limited number of 2D screenings, but mostly 3D. So that does
that adds an extra $2.
Yep.
Yeah, but still a serious amount of money, and we'll be talking a little bit more about the business side of Transformers a little bit later on.
Mm. In Australia, let's just do the top three. Number three down from two, How to Train Your Dragon 2. Number two from 122 Jump Street, and also in the number one position across the ditch, Transformers Age of Extinction.
And their four-day gross was 8.8 million Australian dollars. And, okay, I need somebody who knows the relative populations of both countries to know which country has been more Transformerized than the other.
I'm pretty sure that's New Zealand, because I think we're about 1/15 the size of Australia.
Oh, no, I'm
not
sure.
Isn't Australia 60 million?
No, I don't think so.
Really?
Look, okay. Shall I look it up?
If only there was a worldwide web that had these sorts of solutions.
Oh, if only we had wireless internet.
Well, here we go. Population, Australia.
This
you
is live,
you just set
people.
Me up to make a bad guess before you looked it up. That's,
no, I just had a
this is how podcasting really works.
22.68
Not even close.
No. So I would say that Australia has been probably transformerized to an alarmingly high degree there.
I think pretty similar, because that'd be five times. Right. And once with exchange rates, it's about five times.
See, you always ask the drummer a maths question.
Yeah, I did not go to art. As I always say, I did not go to art school to do mathematics. Lost, totally lost.
All right, I'll do the United Kingdom, and we'll do the top five there. Chef has just been released in the UK, so that's in number five with a million. I've got the US dollar figure here, so 1 million US dollars. Maleficent still holding its own in the top five at number four. 22 Jump Street drops one place to three. The Fault in Our Stars drops one place to number two. And in a terrifying turn of events, ladies and gentlemen, this film is coming to New Zealand. So
is
let's
it?
Not get
I
to
saw the trailer run.
Let's not get too smug about this stuff, because the number one film in the UK, and this is the same week that Monty Python has been dragging it out its greatest hits to thousands and thousands, 20,000 people at the O2 Arena for those Python shows. So the number one film, Mrs. Brown's Boys, the movie. We're all...
yeah.
We are all going to hell.
Oh.
Aww. I had no knowledge of the Mrs. Brown's Boys franchise until I saw the trailer, and I just thought it looked like poorly produced television.
Yep.
Yeah, so we have that to look forward to.
Well, that's right, and the DVDs have been stocking stuffers for a certain caliber of person that you don't like in your family for a long, long time. So, this is but astonishing amount of money, and cheap to produce, and there'll be more. But I call me old fashioned, but I do remember when the Pythons went and made a movie, they made great movies.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the flip side is there's something adorable about the fact that something that low budget and that kind of seemingly just handmade, like in the world of Transformers Age of Extinction, that can still somehow be number one in the UK.
Yep.
Regardless of the fact of whether or not it's any good, there's something that's still kind of charming about the underdog.
I love the way you think. And my challenge is for the one UK listener that I know we have, so Reese Pye, I'm sorry to do this to you, but you are going to have to go to Mrs. Brown's Boys, the movie, and report back to us with two words.
I'm going to hear her groaning in the future now.
All right. And the US, well, no great surprises there. Think Like a Man 2, Drop Like a Stone. How to Train Your Dragon 2 at 3. 22, there's all these numbers. This is like Richie Benoit cricket commentary. 22 Jump Street. And number one in the US, Transformers Age of Extinction. And just another little piece of interesting trivia, that the UK charts, for some reason, the United Kingdom, Ireland, and Malta considered to be one market.
Cool.
Yeah.
Some guy in London must own some cinemas in Malta. Is that takeaway?
I have no idea what the rationale, the historic rationale, something to do with colonialism, I bet.
Hmm.
Well, now we know what the world's watching, it's time for us to tell you whether you should still go and see Transformers, The Age of Extinction. Yeah. Wait a second, just got to turn that little sucker up.
Bring it up! All the way!
You guys have never seen a truck like this before.
Dad, you can't keep spending money on junk.
I don't think it's a truck at all. I think we just found a Transformer.
After all we have done, humans are hunting us. But I fear we are all targets now.
What is that?
Who sent you here?
Okay, wait. Okay, I know I get review films, but that was amazing. I think we just found Transformer. This is so good.
It's worth pointing out this is the fourth Transformer film in this universe where this was the hero Transformer of the first three of worldwide conflicts that was seen on television and somehow... And this doesn't even hit sort of the top 100 of the dumbest things in the film, actually. I'm just sort of mentioning that as an aside. Do you want to jump in and give your overview?
Well, there are a number of things that are interesting about this film. None of which is really anything to do with what actually appears on the screen or comes out of the speakers, right? Like the first thing that's interesting to me is that this is a business, right? We know that Hollywood is a business. We know about lunchboxes and tie-ins and toys and all the rest of it. But this Hasbro thing, they will destroy you if you get in the way of the machine, right? So Shia LaBeouf is being thrown out of Cabaret on Broadway and getting into fights with bums over McDonald's wrappers and spending the night in jail and what have you.
Is this actually happening?
Last week.
Yeah.
This is last week. Shia LaBeouf is in rehab, right?
What?
Basically. And he's been discarded in the same way that Megan Fox got discarded when she was inconvenient to the plan, right? And what do you do when you've got a franchise like this? You get the safest pair of hands in Hollywood, don't you? And that is Mark Wahlberg, right? When things are turning to custard, as Peter Jackson will tell you, when things are turning to custard, you call Mark Wahlberg, and he's not gonna scale any heights, but he's not gonna drop the damn ball, is he?
He somehow manages to hold together a completely incoherent character that at various points in the film says things that are direct opposition to each other.
See, even people in the other room can't hold it together right now. I'm not the only one.
Yeah, he's an amazing at what he's capable of making you buy into. And without him and Stanley Tucci, the human side of this film would be unthinkable.
I'd love to think that with Wahlberg, it's because there's a kind of emptiness inside his head, so that whatever goes flooding into
I know
this is actually not fair. I know, because I've seen him be really good and a really intelligent actor as well. But you get the impression that with him that there's an emptiness there, so that the script can just pop into the fill the gap, and he'll just believe it for whatever moment he's in. My next question though is, what on earth is going on with Stanley Tucci? Like, I know he looks like he's having fun, but With this and that Hunger Games character, he just drives me nuts.
Really?
You enjoyed it?
I haven't seen the Hunger Games character, so I mean, to the extent that I thought he cast the right tone for this film, certainly, as far as not taking it seriously, and because why would you? And having a little bit of fun. And not grunting every single line like Kelsey Grammer did.
Kelsey Grammer did think he was in a very different film, didn't he?
Well, I'm not convinced that Michael Bay actually directs any of his actors, and so it's kind of a masterclass in seeing what actors choose to do with something.
So what does Michael Bay do?
Okay, so here's what I'll give Michael Bay credit for. I saw the first Transformers, which at the time he talked a lot about shoot for the edit. And what he meant is, I'll just put up 8 cameras and then we'll figure it out later. And so the first Transformers was just a Cuisinart mess of stuff, complete with this horrible character design that all the Transformers looked like bags of metal that had been picked up from the dump. And you have these quote-unquote fight scenes that just look like, you know, a Stan Breckage film of somebody throwing metal at the screen and off focus. And I will give Michael Bay this. You say there's nothing on screen, but I'd say there's at least 10 to 12 shots that are 15 to 20 seconds in length that have a real sense of awe of what is going on in terms of bringing together CGI and the real world, and also in a tone that's not too that's quite gleeful in the fact of, hey, this is still kind of a fun blockbuster. This isn't Godzilla, we're all going to be sad now. This isn't, you know, with the exception of Quicksilver, X-Men Days of Future Past had a similar tone. And so many of these blockbusters, like, well, we're destroying the world, this has to be about trauma, this has to be sad. And it's actually like Michael Bay's just like, I just want to blow shit up and have it be cool. Am I allowed to say shit?
You are now.
Yeah. Okay. and I think there's one of those moments every 10 or 12 minutes that are some of the best of those moments. It's just that there's 155 minutes more of film to watch to get to them.
Yeah. You've got to be impressed by the extent that they go to physically to create the world. You know, that this is not all green screen by any means. You know, there's a lot of the car stuff is practical. A lot of the explosion stuff is practical. And I do respect filmmakers that still want to spend their money properly. It's like when you watch a film that has lots of gun play in it, and they actually still want to use real squabs, you know,
right, yeah,
for the blood, you know. Like, yeah, it's a pain in the ass to clean up, and yeah, the laundry bill's huge and what have you, but, you know, it's better.
Yeah, there's a physicality to some of this, but then it's funny because they'll spend the money on that, but then they'll have a chase scene that starts at day and then goes to dusk and comes back to day all in the course of the same thing, and you wonder that you could create a shot where you blow up 20 cars and have a giant robot going through it, but you couldn't change the background of the sky to match the shot before and the shot after. It's a really intriguing auteurist set of principles at work.
There's, have you seen Pain and Gain? Have you seen
See? Oh gosh, it is great.
I've heard wildly divergent reports on Pain
and Gain. We should see it.
I'm very fond of it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, you know, it's definitely a Michael Bay film in the sense that it's like a frat boy jock wanting to tease everybody who's different about their differentness. And I think you see that all the way through this film and all of his others. You know, there's that sort of sense of that sort of blonde surfer jock sense of superiority that is riddled through with all of it. But there's quite a lot of the aesthetic of Pain and Gain that actually seeps into this Transformers movie. Some of the slow-mo, some of the highly saturated stuff is also in there. So, you know, he's growing as a filmmaker.
Well, that attitude thing, I mean, you see it right at the start at that scene at the cinema where they're like, oh, yeah, we don't get any films anymore because all the sequels and the remakes and going digital. And there's all these things where he seems to be striving for either some form of critique or some form of creativity. There's a throwaway reference to waterboarding. There's also this whole Transformers Age of Consent section of the film where suddenly we're thrown into the details of whether or not you're allowed to have sex with a minor in Texas if you had a pre-existing sexual relationship before you were 18, but now are over 18. And this is given, like, a huge amount of oxygen in this film and goes on for, like, and we come back to it. And at the time, I didn't even notice because we just got done with a scene where Mark Wahlberg was willing to have his daughter shot in the head to save Optimus Prime, and nobody ever talks about that in the entire film because they're more worried about whether his 17-year-old daughter has a boyfriend. And it's just, the priorities of this film are somewhat incomprehensible at points.
Pretty much. And so, I don't know the name of the actor, and I can't be bothered looking it up. But the young guy, the young hero who plays the rally driver, with the Irish accent that I don't think was real, pretty bloody sure it wasn't real.
I'll look it up.
Yeah, thanks very much. I mean, he's presumably filling the Shia LaBeouf role in terms of marketability.
Yeah.
But is he got a future, this kid?
Oh, they can do anything in Hollywood if they get their backs behind it. But I don't remember much of him one way or another. I mean, he's young and he can drive a car in the movie. And that's you know, that's as many plot points as anyone else gets. I mean, you know, it's not a character-driven movie. There's one scene where two women talk to each other, and I just imagined they're talking about a bomb in the back. I could just imagine the screenwriter high-fiving Michael, being like, "We passed the Bechdel test this time. Let's move on." And that's, you know, that's a sort of level that characters work at. It's a product, as you say, and that's the interesting thing I think about. You know, for instance, that Transformers the Premake link that I sent you, where this has been so leveraged in so many different ways. The production in China is a key example of that. It's one of the first, apparently, the first film in China that's brought on a local Chinese film company to help distribute it, and so it's had pride of place there, and it's made more money in China on its opening weekend, which is why, and it's part of the reason we suddenly go to China for a half hour in the movie and then decide that the thing we're trying to keep from a major population center, we're going to drive in the center of Hong Kong for,
yep,
because
just because
it's another location we can shoot in.
So you, Kaylee, you've done some research,
right? Yes, I believe the name you're looking for is Jack Rayner. Raynor?
And where's he been? Where would we know him from?
You would know him from What Richard Did and Delivery. and wait for it, Delivery Man.
That was a Starbuck remake, right?
Mm-hmm.
I saw neither of those films.
What Richard Did was in the festival last year, I believe. Yeah. He was the lead character.
Right.
Delivery Man.
Right. Okay, well, that's
He was born in Colorado.
No, we don't. We really don't. No, we don't need to go into facts.
Yeah.
Okay,
I'm not going to doom anybody on their basis of the performance in this film because
totally fair enough. Now I got another question for you, and that is about the geopolitical impact of this particular film. Last week we talked about how we're all basically going to be destroyed by North Korea thanks to James Franco and Seth Rogen. and here we have a film which seems to have no problem whatsoever selling out its own government in favor of the Chinese, because the presidential chief of staff is played by a comedian for total comic relief. He's a hopeless, imbecilic dweeb. You know, even Kelsey Grammer intimidates him, right?
Yeah.
And
we never see the president, who's the actual U.S. commander-in-chief of the armed forces, getting involved with this military assault on Chicago.
That's right. But two-thirds of the way in, we get to meet the Chinese defense minister, and he is Mr. All-Action Definitive, no questions asked, fly the plane, sort this out. You know, there's no question about who this film says should be running the world, surely.
Well, and I think that's, I mean, I didn't quite pick up on that critique when I saw it, but in general, I think that's something that is going to be happening with more and more of these larger films, is that they're going to be made to appeal to a giant theater-growing market in China. And if that means, you know, making the American government look stupid. I mean, we have a long history of making the American government look stupid on film and having, you know, this rogue guy who has part of the, you know, this nefarious agency under his wing. I mean, from the Bourne movies to pretty much every Morgan Freeman movie, there's always some rogue person high up that's doing these things.
This is true. There is a noble tradition of basically doubting your government's good intent. But when you compare it to the Chinese, basically sort of all action, trustworthy, totally reliable. Yeah, it does make you wonder.
Well, the ideology of the film is capitalist, right? It's not about.
Oh, it's consumption. It's destroy it, build it again, destroy it, build it again, destroy it, build it again, because, you know, that's how people get paid.
Well, because they say in the, I haven't seen the third film, but apparently Chicago's destroyed in it, and there's all this hand-wringing to it, and then they go shoot in Chicago, and it looks great. Looks like the same as it ever does.
They're destroyed again.
Yeah, and I'm sure if it appears in Transformers 5, it'll look brand new as well, because, you know, they'll have built it again.
We'll put a link in the show notes to a really cool little story from the Hollywood Reporter, I think, about a reporter was watching the film in a Beijing cinema and how the Chinese audiences were as perplexed as US audiences for the fact that there was so much Chinese product placement in the Texan scenes.
Right.
And they're going, why are they driving one of those cars? Why is there one of those ATM machines? Why is he drinking that soft drink? You know, and it's like they've just crammed so much in that it makes no sense to anybody.
Even the guns are product placed, apparently, which is something that had never occurred to me before. But it's all part of the aesthetic of the film in a way, is that this is so big and so about getting every dollar that you can on screen that they'll just take money from anywhere to make this giant consumption machine, which pretty much is a metaphor for the film.
It is. I've got one final question for you.
Yep.
And that is, bearing in mind all the things that we've said about this film, and that there's a lot, you know, for us who follow the business of film and the construction of film as much as we follow the watching of it and the enjoying of it, there's you know, it's not an uninteresting exercise. But if you just watched films for the fun of it, if you just went and spent your $20 on a Saturday night, like, is this what you would be spending your $20 on?
I would hope not. I mean, in the audience that I...
Have you heard about my film?
Yes. But even putting that aside, I mean, you know, if you have the choice of What We Do in the Shadows or 22 Jump Street, I mean, I had some problems with 22 Jump Street, but I still enjoyed it head or shoulders above this. And I mean, I didn't get real sense that the rest of the audience was enjoying it very much. There are some young people in the same row that I am that tittered at some of the youthful humor in it, but everybody just kind of sat there in submission and the credits start up and they got away. And it's just, it
you know,
feels
I can't,
like you're just,
you know,
this inevitability.
I can't edit that out, don't you?
I'm sorry.
Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay.
You.
Yeah, I feel guilty for spending money on it and being part of the voting with your dollar that contributes to it, but I that's the bullet I took for the team on this one.
No, and we're very, very grateful to you for it. And just the point that I would make is that, you know, that yes, Godzilla was kind of po-faced and took itself very seriously, but people stood and cheered at the end of Godzilla.
Yeah, it was. I found it very humorous.
Mm. Yeah, if Godzilla had realized in the first half of the movie that people who are going to a Godzilla movie had seen Godzilla before, I would have probably not lost patience with it. But I do agree that the end of Godzilla is really when it starts getting exciting and delivering. Mm. I kind of wish Gareth Evans had just a little bit more of Michael Bay in him in terms of that sense of, hey, you know, actually we can show spectacle all the way through and have this be a big thing instead of just holding it out and then having...
Yeah.
This human story that wasn't so engaging.
No, true. So I still haven't decided whether we're going to do 2-word reviews, 3-word reviews, new taglines or whatever. I really think what we're going to have to do is set up a proper survey.
Mm. Can I make a suggestion?
And then I'm going to overrule everybody.
Yes, yep. Yes.
I wrote down 2 quotes from the film, and I think a quote from the film that summarizes the film itself.
Oh,
that requires...
That's level.
You have to take notes.
Yeah, well, just as you're going.
Something that sticks with you.
Okay.
But my favorite quote that I think might have been self-critique was, that's a bad idea, but I'm all about bad ideas.
That's wow. That's very good. Yes, indeed. Okay. Impossible to argue with. So that's our fairly lengthy summing up, probably, and totally appropriate considering the 165-minute running time of the film itself, Transformers Age of Extinction. Yeah, there was a whole lot more I wanted to talk about there in terms of, you know, the complete reconstruction of their backstory of, you know, and the complete lack of respect for all the films that went before. But anyway, you know,
that's
this is
another
the thing.
Show.
I think
it is
complete
another
lack of respect for the audience kind of can act as an umbrella for a lot of that.
Oh, wow.
All right. Time to get a little bit closer to home now.
This is the first day of your new life. Oh, technically the second, but the first full day.
Listen, this can't
be. Welcome to your new life.
Who are you?
Jacob Worthington.
I'm Jacob. Ah!
You've been recast. The little thing on your ankle there, that helps ensure that you don't get tripped up.
How's anyone going to believe that you're me? You don't even look like me.
That's the magic of acting.
So, This is the main reason you're here on the show. Thanks for just tossing that little, you know, riff on Transformers out the way you did there. But you are the writer and director of Jake, which is possibly the second most well-marketed independently released film in playing in cinemas at the moment. And I mean, how did you feel when you finally got your film into cinemas, you started your marketing campaign, and then What We Do in the Shadows turned up and just started to steamroll all of the media? And you know, like, did you feel like you were, you know,
Alistair, my co-producer, has pointed out that he mentioned, so hey, we're coming out the week after What We Do in the Shadows, and both Anushka Koss, my other producer, and I were like, oh, that's okay, I don't think it's going to be that big of a thing. And by the time they're changing the W to a V in Wellington, I realized we'd misjudged that. But at the same time, we've gone with a very small opening, in part because we are self-distributing and we're doing it all off our own back. And we've been really fortunate. And I think because all of that was timed to hit a week or two before that movie came out, we sort of had a clear week where the only thing really opening against us, apart from some small art house releases, was the Transformers movie, which everybody was staying clear of. And so we had a really great week of radio and TV and press coverage that's actually worked out quite well timing wise. And I think it's also a matter of coming off the back of with also Fantail, some good New Zealand movies, where there have been periods where, you know, trying to convince people to see a New Zealand movie, people often might have a bad taste in their mouth from something they haven't liked as much. So I think it's worked out okay. But yeah, there was a bit of a fright when I saw the beer. It was the beer that made me upset. I wanted my own beer. And we could have afforded to do that, but we just didn't think of it.
Tell us a little bit about Jake. Start at the beginning if you're not totally sick of this particular story. How long has your life had Jake in it?
I can't remember. No, about 6 or 7 years. I think somewhere in 2007 I started brainstorming the idea, which came in part from thinking about Jake Gyllenhaal quite a bit, actually. And he was just about to be in Jarhead, if I remember the timing. And I thought, well, are people buying him because he's Jake? Because I don't totally buy it. And what if he was named Jacob? Would people think differently? And, you know, I mean, there's always this thing where people go by either Jake or Jacob, Dan or Daniel, Doug or Douglas, and so on. And what that name says about you is something that, you know, is the first impression of identity. And so I was really interested in this question of who you are. And then I had a night where I was thinking about, like, well, what's going on in my life? I was having a down night. I'm like, well, you know, basically, you know, I'm still employable. I've got a good job. I'm healthy. I've got all these things. What if somebody were to come in the room right now and take all of this? What could they do that I'm not? Because I'm just stuck in these sort of limiting ideas of myself. And I'm like, oh, well, maybe I should write that. And fast forward 7 years, and here we are.
And you always thought of it in terms of a film?
Yes, from the very beginning. Jake was the sixth feature film that I wrote, but the first one that I've made. And about the time that I sort of got serious about writing it, I was started up a filmmaking collective with a few friends, Alistair Ty Sampson, who I mentioned before, and Heath King, and I started a Hybrid Motion Pictures. And we'd just get together every weekend on Sundays, and we'd just write, shoot, edit a scene in 4 hours, and be basically like, who's going to hold the camera? Who's going to hold the knife? Who's going to go, rah! And, you know, and they're all terrible. But it was just, you know, we enjoyed filmmaking, and there was, you know, we wanted to get together. And the only way you get good at filmmaking is by practice. And if the only way you practice is waiting to get a big budget and waiting to develop something for years and then showing up, you haven't had that thing of going through and setting up a series of shots and thinking of that. And so then quickly, a lot of other people were excited and like, yeah, we want to help out too. We like making films, Anushka and our soundy Alex and several other people. And so the momentum built from them to finish the script, which happened in the start of 2009.
And was this one of those films that got shot over a long period of time, over sort of weekends and spare time? Or did you actually sort of everybody take a whole lot of bunch of time off work and get it done in a normal shoot period?
A mix of those strategies. We had a weekend that was sort of a a proof of concept for how to run the set. And then we had 2 weeks where everybody took off work, which was fantastic to have that sort of commitment. And we shot about 60% of the film then. And then we had, you know, the remainder of it was shot in a series of weekends over the following 3 or 4 months.
Right. And when was the final shot put in the can? Listen to me.
the final shot with actors was in November 2009. The film has had a long post-production history, in part because you come off this role of shooting everything and you're like, yeah, this is great. And I worked in editing, and a lot of us worked in editing, and we put together the script as it was on paper. And, you know, and our editor, Peter Evans, had been working along the whole time cutting the film. And so we had a 104-minute cut, and we're like, yeah, this is great. We'll submit it to film festivals. Yeah. And then we didn't get in anywhere. And we kind of took a step back, like, actually, there's a lot better film here, but we were in just such a rush to get it out.
Right.
And so when we went through and did the process of recuts, we didn't take any new shots with actors, but there were a couple places where we put in establishing shots just for timing and help to...
So that 104-minute version that was submitted to film festivals, what are the main differences between that and the one that people can see now?
There's a whole storyline that's completely gone that centers around Jacob's place of work. That's the main big difference. There's a lot of getting out of scenes quicker and getting into the next one earlier. But that was the big thing, that when we locked the edit for the first time. Note to any other filmmakers out there, lock your edit once, because locking it multiple times is not a good idea. But we thought it was at the time. And I was like, well, we need every scene because every scene connects to the next one. And it was only with the benefit of having 6 or 8 months to sit back and look back. It's like, actually, but these 5 or 6 scenes can all go and be replaced by a sound effect. And no one has ever mentioned or cared about what's no longer on screen there, because there's so much other stuff that's going on screen that people are engaged with.
This is a film that's for all of its low budget and it's, you know, made by matesness, is still really high concept, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is one of those Michael Crichton sci-fi movies of the 70s. You know, this imagine if there was an organization who, if they decided you weren't doing well enough in your role in life, they could just come in and bring somebody else in to play your role for you. But you've managed to pull it off without a lot of the sci-fi trappings. I mean, is that the kind of sci-fi that you like, the ideas-y sci-fi?
Yeah, it's funny because I never used the word sci-fi when I was making it. We talked about magical realism, and we talked about Charlie Kaufman films, you know, the adaptations and being John Malkovich's of the world, and maybe things that are a bit more surreal. And it was only later when we were sending it out to the world and people were saying, well, it's a sci-fi film, but it's not very sci-fi, so I don't know if it'll work for a sci-fi market. And we're like, it's a sci-fi film? But actually, it was David Larson's review where he, and speaking to him in person or over Twitter, I think, where he talked about sci-fi in this larger sort of speculative fiction sort of thing that, you know, authors like Philip Dick, who I grew up on and loved, are such a huge part of that, where it may or may be set in the present or it may be set in the future, but you have this idea that shifts your sense of reality. And there's this huge ask at the center of Jake, and that was what was always frightening, is that we've got an actor that's replacing this person that looks nothing like him. And we didn't know until the first test screening whether people would buy it. And, you know, we could have got to that and just been like, well, that was a bold choice that really didn't work. And thankfully people were buying it.
Because I mean, we've got two films in the New Zealand International Film Festival, Kaylee, that are doppelganger films, and you know, this is and doppelganger,
one of which is starring Jake Gyllenhaal.
The irony is that weirdly lost on me. Yes.
and these are films where filmmakers get to sort of test their technical ability, don't they, with those doppelganger films, and the technology sort of allows them to do all sorts of funky stuff that they weren't able to do before. Is there anything that you wished you could have done with Jake, like if you'd have had one big dollop of money was dropped on you for one day, you could have said, you know, bam, we're gonna do this?
I don't think so from that technical side. I mean, it's funny you mentioned that because Layden actually auditioned for both parts and thought he might be both Jake and Jacob. And but in terms of the how our film functions, I think it works much better that they don't look alike because it's sadder. You know, in terms of having money dropped on you, I mean, production design and things like that, we, you know, there could have been more exploration of creating a world instead of having, you know, we're shooting it, you know, what was available often and dressing it to some extent. But those are also just things that you learn along the way of how to get value out of that. I think any money would bring with it a set of attendant expectations is the thing. You don't get free money. And I've thought about this a lot.
No. You have to pay the Chinese government, don't you?
Yeah, but for instance, this wasn't a script that was rejected from funding. This was a script that, because of our background, we decided to make ourselves. And so it was only afterwards, when we got our initial set of rejections, that we were told, this is kind of a strange film that doesn't really fit check audience boxes. And if only you'd made it a bit more sci-fi, and instead of, you know, casting Greg Johnson as the guy who works for that, had two young guys in sunglasses, and instead of just saying it's the magic of acting, that, you know, there was some little device that Layden had that cast a little hologram over him that made him look like it. And I didn't think about those things beforehand. I'm glad I didn't have to think about, will you make those changes to make that film, because I'm really happy with how the film's come out, and the audience response hasn't been, I wish there'd just been a little hologram around him and that would explain everything. I think everybody gets that there's this greater sadness because of the fact that they look different, and because there's not an explanation, it's not dumbing it down for the audience, is what I'm getting as feedback from people.
This is a film that's now playing at Selected Sessions in Auckland. It's going to be playing Selected Sessions in Wellington from next Thursday.
Next Friday, actually.
Next Friday, yes. Okay. Ooh.
So
specific, yes.
Well, because what we've done is, because we don't have a lot of sessions, and we wanted to try to make each session as event as much as possible, as we've had both our opening nights on Friday. So we opened last Friday at the Academy with a sold-out Q&A, which was fantastic and good fun. And Sarah Watt hosted that, and people stuck around for 45 minutes to ask us how you make something like this on no money. And then we've got our last session in Auckland this Saturday, the 5th at 2 p.m., at Academy, and then at the 11th at Paramount, we'll have our opening night with a Q&A hosted by Jonathan King. So that'll hopefully also be a great getting into the guts of indie filmmaking discussion as well.
I would recommend that people are there for that. I saw him interview Guillermo del Toro at the Paramount, and it was an outstanding evening, and great discussion between two very eloquent dudes, and I expect it'll be exactly the same.
Yeah, well, we'll have both our producers there, and possibly some of the actors as well, because this is really a whole team film. I mean, I'm the writer and the director, and I'm one of the producers, but it's, you know, it's because of this hybrid team that the film exists and looks as good as it does, and without them, you know, it's not just all about me.
It's 2014, and Jake is now in cinemas, and presumably you and your producing team will continue to work in terms of getting it in front of people. But what are you doing now? Your next challenge in life doesn't appear to be film related.
Yeah, what happened was, you know, obviously Jake's taken a long time, and none of us are independently wealthy, and we've had to work, and there's been projects in the background. And at the start of last year, I fell in love with a true story set in New Zealand and New Caledonia during World War II involving weapons testing. And I thought about the challenges of self-funding a period piece involving giant explosions and multiple locations and hundreds of extras. And I thought, maybe I'll write it as a book first. and then if there's life in it, go from that. So I applied to the IML and got in, and I'm currently working on that book, as in theory, as we speak. In practice, releasing your own film can be a bit distracting, but I'm carrying on with that. But also, Hybrid as a group is developing other features, and both Anushka and Alistair have features that they'd like to direct. And but at the moment, it is this, because it is, you know, pretty much the three of us as a team pushing this out to the world, and talking to the cinemas around the country who are actually getting excited about playing it, which we wasn't really part of our plan. We're just like, well, if we can show it in Auckland and Wellington and our mates and family can come along, then it'll be a success. And the response has been much bigger than that, which is really fantastic.
Well, Doug, we just can't be happier for you than we are. And I love seeing the film and very much looking forward to being at that Q&A in Wellington on the it's on at the opening night.
Yeah, it's at the Paramount at the 11th at 8:30.
Fantastic. All right. Well, it's time for some news now.
Well, the big festival news this week is Wellington tickets went on sale. Very exciting. So people are snapping up those tickets. Speaking of tickets on sale, mm-hmm. Nick Cave's solo tour went on sale this morning, and I believe it's sold out in Wellington.
Yeah, I was, you know, for a moment there it was on my radar, and then I thought, you know, that would mean I have to stop work, go and do something. You know, like I just couldn't. Yeah. It was not a day for me to spend in queues for tickets for things, even online. So good luck to everybody. I mean, Nick Cave, fantastic performer. It's going to be amazing.
I'll tell you about it afterwards.
Yeah.
But also, of course, people who are excited to go to the Nick Cave live show at the festival, there is the 20,000 Days on Earth, which is a fantastic documentary about Nick Cave and the recording of the new album with Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. And there's also another small documentary called Tender out of Australia about the natural death movement. And Nick Cave and Warren Ellis did the music for it. So you can get like all your Nick Cave in, like all at once. It's happening.
It's Nick Cave year.
It's Nick Cave year in New Zealand. So that is my news from the festival. Nick Cave, Nick Cave.
And tickets selling well for the two locations that are currently on sale?
Definitely, yep. Lots of excitement.
Anything sold out that we should know about?
Red dots on those boards. That's what we care about.
Not that I have had reported to me yet. So
I'm going to buy tomorrow, so I'm just nervous that I might have missed out on something.
Yeah. What are you doing here? Why aren't you online?
I'll hand you my tablet. So yeah, get your tickets, people. There's lots of great films, of course. So yeah. Let us know at Rancho Podcast what you're looking forward to seeing at the festival and what you've purchased.
Mm.
I'd like to know.
Okay.
We'd like to know. Moving on. Writer-director Paul Mazursky passed away on Tuesday at the age of 84, described as colorful by The Hollywood Reporter. Mazursky was best known for counterculture comedies like Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, An Unmarried Woman, and Down and Out in Beverly Hills. He was a 5-time Oscar nominee.
And I saw a tweet yesterday from the director Mark Romanek saying that he and James Gray once invited Paul Mazursky to their film club in New York to present one of his films and speak to them, and he was just the most generous guy, and I thought that's all very well and good. But sorry, Mark Romanek and James Gray had a film club in New York
and you weren't invited, Dan. How insulting. In New Zealand, the Screen Directors Guild has become the Directors and Editors Guild of New Zealand, reflecting, they say, our broadening representation of screen storytellers. At the same time, they announced two international mentorship schemes. You can find out more at www.degnz.co.nz.
Yep.
Boom. In news and no commentary?
Ah, no. Just saying, I probably need to join that now because it's got both of my jobs in it.
True. Get it on it. In news that we missed last week, a raft of new members were inducted into the Academy, including luminaries like Jason Statham, Rob Riggle, and Josh Hutcherson.
I'm just staggered that Rob Riggle is now a member of the Academy.
Who is Rob Riggle?
Rob Riggle is the, you know, in 22 Jump Street, when they go into prison to see the guy that they put into jail the time before? That's Rob Riggle.
Okay.
Oh, he's so gross. It soon came to notice that only 74 of the 271 invitees were women, and only one female director, Gina Prince Blythewood, who made The Secret Life of Bees.
One female director invited to join the Academy. It's just like, what are they thinking?
Do you follow Lexi Alexander on Twitter?
No, but I should perhaps.
Yeah, she's been a strong advocate over this past few months for the lack of female directors in Hollywood and trying to find productive solutions to that recurring problem. So it's a good person to follow. And she made Punisher Warzone, which is still my favorite Marvel Comics movie.
That's two things that I need to write down. Okay. And that is our news. Look, I've just had a look at how long this is going. On the last podcast that we did, the old show, we used to take great pride in the fact that we worked exceptionally hard to get our shows in under an hour. And maybe I need to get a giant clock on the wall there, because the way the studio is set up here, the conversation is so good, I lose all track of time. Anyway, we'll just have a quick shifty at Ernest and Celestine.
What's your name?
Ernest.
I'm Celestine. A bear and a mouse cannot be friends. Listen, Ernest, will you do me a favor?
Do you know the story of the little mouse who did not believe in the big bad bear? Celestine, did you bring him here?
Well, that's the English language version of Ernest and Celestine, featuring luminaries like Lauren Bacall, William H. Macy, and Forrest Whitaker as Ernest. And Doug, I know that you saw this at the film festival last year. Was that the English language version or the French subtitled version?
That was the subtitled version last year that I saw.
Right.
The room full of kids who ate it up, regardless.
Yeah, because it's just glorious, isn't it? It's just the cutest little thing you've ever seen in your life.
My face hurt from smiling at the end. It was just 75 minutes of nonstop joy. We could just stop there, because
we pretty much could.
And that's our show.
This is a film for all the family. And it's got enough hints of subtext and sort of darkness in there to that it's got a little bit of meat on those bones. You know, it's not just cute. It's not just fluffy and clouds and unicorns.
Yeah, it's the directors. Two of them did a film called A Town Called Panic, which put in the incredibly strange section a few years back, and is a very different style of animation, where it's plasticine figures and things like that. Whereas here, it looks all like watercolors. But I think some of that sense of anarchy and surreality definitely carries over. And there's a scene where they paint their van to camouflage it, for instance. It's just one of those moments of illogic that delights.
And the other kind of freaky illogic is this idea that rats need their incisors in order to be able to survive, which we know, but they also need them in order to be able to talk. And when they lose those front, just one of those front teeth, then no one can understand a word they say. And what these little mice do is go and find bear teeth to replace them. I mean, it's just a nutso idea, isn't it? But you sort of buy into it, and everything's done with such just so cute. You just want to eat them all up.
Yeah, it's just nonstop big hug of a movie. But it does have those little elements of, yes, also we've got dentistry, and then meanwhile next door we're selling as much sugar as we can. And so there's just a bit of cleverness to it that I think, even though it's a perfect kids movie, that if you're an adult, you'll still come away satisfied if you have anything within your heart.
Yeah, exactly. And only 75 minutes long, which, you know, more please, more like that. Ladies and gentlemen, that is our show for this week. Next week, those pesky apes are back. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes hits screens all over the world, and we're going to see if we can find somebody from Weta Dij to talk about their role in it. If you've enjoyed this episode, you can subscribe at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious, where you will find a way to communicate with us. You can either do that via email, or you can make a comment on the site. We're now live in the iTunes store. We have 3 episodes live, so I'm pretty sure that our iPhone and Android apps will be out very soon. I must chase that up. What about social media?
You can find us on Twitter at Rancho Podcast. That's RANCHO Podcast, all one word, on Twitter. We will be tweeting incessantly about things we think are interesting and things that you tweeted us that we enjoy, all that stuff. And you can also interact with us on Letterboxd too. Username is Rancho Notorious.
Yeah, we haven't actually done anything on Letterboxd yet, but
we're getting there.
It's because I've been sick. I've been sick this week. The show is a Funerals and Snakes production. Season 1 is executive produced by Robert Catto, Random Films, Claire Queret, Mark Cuby, Anthony S. Pratt, Fred Thompson, and Matthew Buchanan. The theme music is Ennio Morricone's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, performed by Los Plantronics. You can buy it at the iTunes store. And we're playing you out with some more music. Here is Celestine Celestine's theme by Vincent Courtois from Ernest and Celestine. Why did I type Oscar and Celestine? I was Oscar obsessed when I typed the script.
It deserved the Oscar for best animated film, but lost to some other little Disney thing.
It probably deserves to be number one in Japan for 15 weeks in a row as well, but it's not. That's not happening either.
That's a cruel universe.
Thanks very much to Doug Dillerman. It's been an absolute pleasure having you here at Rancho Notorious.
Thank you, Dan. And thank you, Kaylee.
Thanks.
We're off to have some dinner. Thanks very much for listening. That's good night from me, Dan Slevin.
And good night from me, Kaylee.